Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
I'm Jeff Steinberg. Welcome to a special edition of the LaRouche Connection, which we call The Guns of August. As many of you are probably aware, the Middle East situation has gone from bad to worse, and there is now widespread expectation of the outbreak of at least a limited war involving a massive Israeli invasion and military operation in the Palestinian territories. The question of whether that war will break out into a broader regional war has been widely covered in the media in the United States and around the world. But the issues that have not been discussed in the regular media, and which will be a feature of this special edition of the LaRouche Connection, involves the broader forces at play behind the scenes, who wish to use the Sharon government in Israel, and perhaps a post-Sharon government, even more fanatical than the present regime, to launch a war in the Middle East that would rapidly spread around the globe and become a new worldwide religious war consistent with what Zbigniew Brzezinski, Samuel Huntington, Henry Kissinger, and others in the Anglo-American establishment refer to and long for as the clash of civilization. If this war does not erupt in the Middle East during the month of August, which has been historically a favorite month for the launching of global conflicts on the part of the international oligarchy, the reason for that will be that Lyndon LaRouche, Executive Intelligence Review, and other allied forces around the world placed such a public spotlight on those pushing for this new conflagration that they were forced to back down. At a webcast in Washington, D.C., before an audience of several hundred diplomats and political activists on July 24th, just several days ago, Lyndon LaRouche emphasized that in order to prevent the outbreak of this new clash of civilizations in the Middle East during the month of August, it is imperative that the United States government, which alone has the power and authority to prevent this, steps in forcefully and blocks Sharon and the even more fanatical crazies inside Israel from launching this conflagration. Now, back at the beginning of June of this year, New Federalist newspaper and Executive Intelligence Review magazine began publishing a series of exposés which have already contributed mightily to holding back the guns of August from already having been detonated earlier this summer. On July 11th, New Federalist reported on its front page that Sharon and elements within his war cabinet had been prepared to activate a full-scale invasion of the Palestinian territories immediately following the June 1st suicide bombing at a discotheque in Tel Aviv, Israel, that claimed 20 lives and injured more than 100 people. That incident was precisely the pretext that Sharon and others in his cabinet had hoped for to justify a full-scale military invasion of the so-called Area A, the territories fully under the control of Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority. What New Federalist exposed at the time, based on interviews with well-placed Arab, Israeli, and American intelligence sources, was a full-scale assault on population centers in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, using F-16 and F-15 fighter bombers, a ground invasion into Palestinian territories, aimed at forcing a stampede of evacuation of refugees across the Jordan River into the territory of Jordan. What we warned at the time was that Sharon and some of the most radical elements in his cabinet were fully prepared to attempt to carry out the Jordan is Palestine operation, which has been at the heart of Sharon's greater Israel fanaticism for decades, since the very beginning of his career shortly after the founding of the State of Israel. At that time, a combination of factors prevented that invasion from taking place. Elements inside the Israeli cabinet, centered around Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, opposed the move. There was a certain limited degree of pressure from the Bush administration in Washington and from elsewhere in the United States, Europe, Russia, and other leading capitals around the world. Sharon decided to make a tactical decision to delay, not cancel, his war plan of genocide against the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian people by presenting himself as a, quote, moderate who did not go with the demands for a full-scale military retaliation after the June 1st Tel Aviv disco bombing. Sharon, in his own mind, was laying the basis for a justifiable assault the next time such a terrorist incident were to take place. Now, in the aftermath of that initial bombing incident, Sharon used the pretext to completely stymie forward movement on the Mitchell Plan, which had been released shortly before that, which set out a precise new timetable for confidence-building measures, ceasefire, and eventual resumption of the peace talks between Israel and the Palestinian Authority that were brutally cut off after Sharon himself instigated a major provocation in September of 2000 by personally visiting the Islamic holy sites at the Temple Mount and in effect asserting permanent Israeli hegemony and authority over those important Islamic sites. The press internationally, shortly after the Tel Aviv bombing, reported on the fact that it was, in fact, an Israeli intelligence informant, a Shin Bet informant, who had been the driver of the taxi that brought the suicide bomber to that site in Tel Aviv where the explosion, the suicide bombing, took place June 1st. This is a very important fact because, as EIR later exposed, one of the key assets in Ariel Sharon's arsenal for waging genocidal war crimes against the Palestinian people and against the leadership of the Palestinian Authority is the fact that crucial elements among the Palestinian radicals, particularly the Islamist faction around Hamas, have been sponsored by and in some cases absolutely controlled by Sharon and radical elements within the Israeli authorities for more than 20 years. Go back in time to the late 1970s when the original Begin government was in power in Israel, when Ariel Sharon held various ministerial posts, first agricultural minister and later minister of defense. Within the Israeli-occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza, Sharon and other Israeli officials sponsored and nurtured the launching of the Hamas movement, specifically as a counter-gang to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the Fatah, and those other elements associated with Yasser Arafat. It was only the Israeli occupying authorities that were able to issue licenses for the creation of daycare centers, schools, food kitchens, health clinics, and other rudimentary elements of the basic infrastructures of life in the occupied territories, and systematically people who later became leading figures in the Hamas movement and other radical Islamist movements were given those licenses as opposed to the Arafat people. So a parallel governing structure centered around Hamas and around other Islamic radicals was nurtured by Sharon and others as an explicit alternative to the Palestinian leadership. In 1982, using the pretext of the assassination attempt against the Israeli ambassador in London, Shlomo Argov, an assassination that was widely believed to have been carried out by Israeli Mossad agents inside the Abu Nidal organization, Ariel Sharon launched a full-scale invasion of Lebanon, even behind the back of Prime Minister Begin, and oversaw the mass executions of unarmed, innocent Palestinian men, women, and children at the refugee camps outside of Beirut known as Sabra and Shatila. Sabra and Shatila. Recently, in a court of law in Belgium, in Europe, a lawsuit has been filed against Ariel Sharon for the war crimes that he was involved in committing at that time of the Sabra and Shatila invasions. In a future edition of the LaRue Connection, we will explore the evidence, the overwhelming evidence, against Ariel Sharon. The filing of that suit early in the spring of this year was yet another factor that prompted Sharon to perhaps hold back a bit from carrying out his war drive. Now, following the original New Federalist expose of the Jordan is Palestine war plan of early June, Lyndon LaRouche issued an extraordinarily important statement warning that the next Middle East war to break out would be the first war that Israel would lose because Israel was incapable of defeating the Palestinian Intifada. Israel obviously has a massive military arsenal. It has the ability to defeat its Arab neighbors almost certainly in a conventional war, given its air superiority and other high-tech advances over the Arab countries. What's more, it is well known that Israel possesses a large arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, including several hundred nuclear warheads with delivery systems capable of reaching any area in the Middle East. If there is one nation on the face of the earth that indeed warrants the term rogue state in possession of weapons of mass destruction, it is not Saddam Hussein's Iraq, it is not Khatami's Iran, it is not Kim Jong-il's North Korea, but it is Israel under madman Ariel Sharon. And so LaRouche spelled out in this memo very clearly that the kind of war that Israel faces, with 3 million Palestinians living inside the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, with nearly 30% of the Israeli population inside the original 1967 borders, now made up of Israeli Arabs, the prospects of an irregular war presents the only kind of warfare in which Israel would be overwhelmed, ultimately defeated, and in fact, it would mean the demise of the State of Israel on a permanent basis. Despite that, the guns of August persist. Why is that the case? Well, one of the principal reasons is that the main architects of the war danger now emanating from the Middle East are not people inside Israel. Oh yes, there are absolute crazies inside the Israeli government. People far more insane than Ariel Sharon. People like General Ram Zevi, who is a minister in the Sharon cabinet and who is a fanatical advocate of the idea of the mass expulsion of all of the Palestinians and all of the Arab Israelis into Jordan. However, these crazies are currently, at least, under the Sharon coalition government, bounded to elements in the Labor Party that are certainly far too rational to support such a suicidal war. The real architects of the growing danger of a global religious war emanating from the Middle East, perhaps even involving the use of nuclear weapons, are not located in the Middle East at all. They're located in London. They're located on Wall Street. Some of them are located in some of the think tanks that dot the Potomac River right here in Washington, D.C. People like Samuel Huntington, the author of the now infamous book, The Clash of Civilizations, argue that the financial oligarchy, faced with an out-of-control collapse of their international financial system, and faced with other looming political threats of adversarial coalitions rising up to again support the idea of the nation state over and against the power of the financial oligarchy, are becoming increasingly desperate. And it is those people who believe that a clash of civilizations, pitting Islam and eventually the nations of Asia, particularly China, against the West, represents the way to go. overturn the entire global chessboard rather than allow the forces representing the nation-state system, scientific and technological progress, to come to the fore and remove them from power. Henry Kissinger, in a recent book about American foreign policy, said very bluntly that the world no longer operates under the rules that were set forth at the conference, the Treaty of Westphalia, in 1648, that ended more than 100 years of religious warfare on the European continent. And so these people, representing the core of the Anglo-American financial oligarchy, are at the heart of the guns of August. Their view is that in the Middle East today, there exists the possibility of detonating a religious war of such horror and such scope that it will soon engulf the entire planet. Last week, Lyndon LaRouche warned that in order to activate this kind of war danger, the fanatics in London, in Washington, on Wall Street, may even consider the assassination of Ariel Sharon. Sharon may be a madman, but he understands, as a longtime political survivor, what the boundary conditions are in which he is able to operate. And functioning in a coalition government with the Labor Party, coming under mounting pressure from Washington, and even more severe pressure from the governments of continental Europe, the European Union, Sharon will tend to operate on a more limited scale. Invade the Palestinian territories? Absolutely. Carry out targeted assassinations, perhaps even of Yasser Arafat? Absolutely. But such a more limited conventional engagement might not do the trick in the eyes of the Samuel Huntingtons and Zbigniew Brzezinskis and Prince Philips of the world. Therefore, LaRouche recently put out the assessment that an assassination of Sharon, particularly an assassination that could be attributed to Palestinian or Islamic, perhaps Iraqi or Iranian circles, would certainly lead to the coming into power in Israel of the kind of extreme fanatics under the tight noose of this Anglo-American loony faction that would be willing to unleash nuclear weapons against Iran or Iraq and set the entire Middle East aflame in such a way that it would spread overnight to engulf the entire world. These madmen have run out of ideas. They've run out of concepts on how to run the world. They see themselves threatened by an emerging alliance within Eurasia of Russia, China, India, the countries of the ASEAN region of Southeast Asia, other countries looking towards the development of infrastructure and transportation corridors that can create the core of a new economy on a worldwide scale, an economy centered around the building of the Eurasian land bridge, a proposal that Lyndon LaRouche revived, a proposal that was the cornerstone of American economic foreign policy in the second half of the 19th century, and a policy that LaRouche intends to again revive as a cornerstone of American policy once again. That combination, the United States aligned with a Eurasian land bridge combination centered around Russia, China, India, with heavy cooperation from Japan, poses the kind of existential threat to the London-centered Anglo-American oligarchy such that they would go to war and blow up the planet sooner than allow that to happen. And this is at the heart of the guns of August that are now poised to be set loose in the Middle East. Now, when Ariel Sharon made his first visit to the Temple Mount to bring down the Israeli government in late September of the year 2000, Executive Intelligence Review rushed to press a special report, who is behind the new religious war in the Middle East. We revealed documentation that had been being assembled for years, ever since the assassination of the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, revealing a top-down structure involving the highest levels of the British monarchy and British Freemasonry, the most fanatical Zionist wings of the fundamentalist movement inside the United States, centered out of the Dallas Theological Seminary and associated with people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and an apparatus inside Israel, historically nurtured and protected by Ariel Sharon, but involving fanatics who are prepared to unleash this new holy war in the Middle East by blowing up the religious sites at the Temple Mount. In February of this year, the LaRouche Connection aired a special broadcast revealing the name, rank, serial number of the British Masons, the Israeli crazies, and the American fundamentalists behind this Temple Mount plot. And in order to provide our listeners and our viewers with a reminder about the insanity and fanaticism of those who are now preparing to launch the Guns of August, we're going to replay at this point crucial parts of that broadcast from February of this year to show you the nature, the ideology, the irrationalism of those people on the ground, the manipulated pawns, as well as the high-level ideologues behind the present drive to blow up the Middle East. Let's take a look at that footage, and then we'll come back for brief comments afterwards. In December 2000, the editors of Executive Intelligence Review magazine rushed to print with a special report titled, "Who is Sparking a Religious War in the Middle East?" The decision to go to print with material of crucial importance documenting who were the assassins of the late Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and who were the forces behind the efforts to blow up the Middle East through a religious war that would last for decades, was brought on by the September 26th visit by Ariel Sharon to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the site of two of the holiest places of Islam, accompanied by more than 1,000 Israeli police and soldiers. Sharon's provocative visit to the Temple Mount predictably sparked Palestinian protest demonstrations and an Israeli deadly force reaction. In a matter of weeks, 8 years of effort at achieving a meaningful peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians was down the drain, and as the result of that, the Barak government soon collapsed. On February 6, 2001, culminating that provocation, Ariel Sharon himself was elected Prime Minister of Israel by a 63% majority of the vote. This reflected a terrorization and literally a driving of a majority of Israelis so insane that they were willing to put the butcher of Lebanon, Ariel Sharon, for the first time in his long career, into the prime minister's office. It is no secret among analysts of the Middle East situation that the region is now on the verge of a new war, a regional war that would not last for 6 days or 6 weeks, but would engulf the entire region for years and would likely trigger an oil shock of far greater consequence than the 1973 Yom Kippur War and the oil shocks that followed after that. So the appropriate question that has been posed by Lyndon LaRouche in the context of these developments is, how can we avoid such a horrific war? The answer, which is documented in the pages of the EIR special report, is that the key players in the region, the Arabs, the Palestinians, the Israelis, have to begin the process of healing and peacemaking by recognizing that for decades, indeed for more than 150 years, they have been pawns of a British oligarchical strategic game to keep the Middle East inflamed, manipulated around religious and territorial passions, irrational, so that the British would have a war spark that could be triggered on a moment's notice for not just regional, but global purposes. Indeed, following the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, a team of Executive Intelligence Review investigators conducted a year-long inquiry into the forces behind the Rabin assassination, which, like the recent Sharon provocation at the Temple Mount, was aimed at preventing the peace process from going forward at a crucial potential breakthrough moment. What we learned in the course of months of investigation, hundreds of interviews, more than 30 to 40 hours of taped interviews, is that a highly organized top-down structure was behind the assassination of Rabin and is today the string pullers behind the drive for a war in the Middle East through the imposition of Sharon in power of in Israel and all that that represents. Among the leading figures responsible for these current unfolding developments are a network of high-level British Freemasonic operatives tied directly to the British royal family. Today, the titular head of the Grand Mother Lodge of British Freemasonry is the Duke of Kent, the first cousin of Queen Elizabeth. But as EIR investigators learned, particularly with respect to the Temple Mount project, the man who runs the day-to-day affairs of British Masonry on a worldwide scale, including in Jerusalem, is the Marquis of Northampton, who has been one of the leading architects of the Temple Mount project. The Marquis of Northampton's leading assistant is Professor Giulio Di Bernardo, who was installed as the Grand Master of Italian Special Masonry at a ceremony in 1995, which was attended by the Marquis of Northampton. In an interview with EIR, Di Bernardo blatantly said, and this is a quote, "A new utopia may be based on the Kabbalah. I see a utopia based on Jewish mysticism, but Jewish mysticism as a place, a material place, Solomon's temple. This is my intention. This is my will." Now, to ensure that the hands and feet inside Israel were put in place to manipulate the assault on Islamic holy sites, an event that would trigger a religious war of unfathomable consequences, many years ago, in 1967, immediately after the Israeli military occupied the entirety of the city of Jerusalem and surrounded the Temple Mount, Dr. Asher Kaufman was dispatched to Israel by the British Masonic circles, particularly the Quattuor Coronati Lodge of British Masonry.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
In an interview several years ago, Dr. Kaufman accounted for some of his activities around the Temple Mount project of the high levels of British Masonry.
"I think I spent about 2 months investigating theoretically whether one could trust this piece of information from our ancient records that the blood drained into the Kidron Valley. And when I was convinced, I came to the realization that perhaps this particular record called Tractate Midot, Midot meaning dimensions, the dimensions of the temple, that this would enable me to work out where the temple stood."
Joining Dr. Kaufman in Jerusalem on behalf of the highest levels of the British oligarchy and British Masonry was a Dutch anthropologist, Leen Rittmeyer, who was a personal employee of the Rothschild family and was likewise dispatched to Jerusalem to provide the, quote, academic cover for the continuing preparations for the assault on the Temple Mount that has now reached a frenzied point with Sharon's coming into power in Israel.
After having worked for several years with Professor Benjamin Mazar on the Temple Mount excavation as his field architect, I became interested in the historical development of the Temple Mount.
The British oligarchy's Temple Mount project would have been impossible to carry out were it not for the fact that the high-level anthropologists deployed to Jerusalem were immediately put in contact with fanatical Jewish fundamentalists who were equally committed to the idea of the blowing up of the Islamic sites at the Temple Mount and the building of the Third Temple as a prophetic religious event. Back in 1967, literally at the moment that Israel occupied the entirety of the city of Jerusalem, a young Israeli paratrooper named Gershom Solomon established a group called the Temple Mount Faithful, which to this day has played a pivotal role in attempting to create the conditions for the blowing up of the Islamic holy sites. Recently, Gershom Solomon staged one of many demonstrations outside of the Temple Mount.
We shall never give up, nor on the Temple Mount, nor on Jerusalem, and nor the land of Israel. I want to say to all the world, the struggle of the Temple Mount and Eretz Israel Faithful Movement is the struggle of all the Jewish and the Israeli people. For this holy mountain, for this city Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, and for the land of Israel. This struggle will continue and stronger. I want to say here two important facts. First of all, we are opening now a very important law struggle on the ownership of the Temple Mount. We will come and say everyone in the world, the Temple Mount belongs to the Jewish people by the will of God.
You'll hear right now directly from Gershom Solomon, the head of the Temple Mount Faithful, that their patron, their supporter all along throughout this entire process has been none other than Ariel Sharon.
Now we continue all the other events. We shall go and read Megillat Eicha. We shall pray. We shall go to the other gates. We shall go to the house of Ariel Sharon.
Gershom Solomon epitomizes the irrationalist religious fundamentalism that has gripped large numbers of people in Israel, particularly those in groups like the Temple Mount Faithful, the Gush Emunim, the settlers' movements in the occupied territories, who have been historically financed and politically protected by General Sharon.
Gershom Solomon, head of the group called the Temple Mount Faithful, who have the cornerstone and want to erect it on the Temple Mount and start the construction of the Third Temple. Gershom shared with us his vision from top the Western Wall overlooking the Temple Mount.
You know, when I'm so close to the place, I feel that I am not here. I am in the clouds and inside the place. You know, I see the first temple, which King Solomon built it. I don't see the Dome of the Rock here. I see a strange thing here. I see the first temple. I see the second temple. And more than this, I see the third temple, which will be rebuilt in this place exactly, very soon, very close to our time. Maybe tomorrow, maybe after 1 week, but now, and you and I and all the generation will have the big privilege to come to this place in the original situation, the biblical situation, when the temple is here, and the temple will become again a center of Israel, a center of the redemption of the people of Israel, and then all the nations from all the world will come and pray as God said. My house will be a house of praying for all the nations in all the world.
The plot to blow up the Temple Mount, unfortunately, is not simply a project of a group of insane Jewish fundamentalist fanatics and some greater Israel operatives like the current Prime Minister Sharon. The mayor of Jerusalem, a historical close political ally of Sharon inside the Likud party, makes it very clear that he too is committed to the idea of the rebuilding of the Third Temple, no matter what the consequences are.
The whole world refers to it as the Temple Mount, and yet few people report to themselves what's the significance of the name. The significance is that that's where the Jewish temple was originally built. This is the most sacred place for 3,000 years of Jewish history.
There's yet a third element behind this Temple Mount insanity. And that element has grave domestic implications for the United States as well. Here in the U.S., there is a very extensive network of Christian fundamentalists whose theological center is the Dallas Theological Center in Dallas, Texas, and who are as fanatically devoted to the blowing up of the Temple Mount and the rebuilding of the Third Temple of Jerusalem as is Gershom Solomon and the Jewish fanatics that we've already seen. Countless videos and books and audio tapes have been produced by a proliferation of televangelist organizations in the United States advocating the building of the Third Temple, the blowing up of the Islamic holy sites, and in almost every instance, there is a full and complete acknowledgement that the consequences will likely be a hideous religious war that will engulf the Middle East for a long time to come and likely lead to World War III.
There's a great controversy over the Temple Mount area. Today, the Jews cannot go up on top of the Temple Mount area. They must worship below at the Wailing Wall. What a paradox. For 1967, when they liberated Eastern Jerusalem, they had the opportunity to take control of the Temple Mount area, but Moshe Dayan didn't do it. What a dilemma. Today, there's this tremendous desire to rebuild the Third Temple, but it's impossible. They just can't do it unless they risk World War III.
One of the most active of the Christian evangelicals in the United States, involved in raising funds and inciting others to join in this fanatical drive to blow up the Islamic sites in Jerusalem, is Randall Price, who's written a series of books and made a series of widely circulated videotapes advocating exactly this.
Scholars have different opinions concerning the location of the temple in Jerusalem. Archaeologists such as Dr. Dan Bahat, the director of the Western Wall Tunnel Excavations, and Dr. Meir Ben-Dov, chief excavator of the southern wall of the Temple Mount, both place Solomon's first temple and Zerubbabel and Herod's second temple at the traditional western site on the Temple Mount. This is the site today occupied by the Islamic Dome of the Rock. Dr. Asher Kaufman, a physicist and longtime student of the temple, proposes an alternate location in the northeastern corner of the Temple Mount. While no one in Israel at present may agree on the precise place where the temple was built in the past, we know without a doubt when the temple will be built in the future. According to sacred scripture, the temple predicted by the prophet Ezekiel in the last 9 chapters of his book will be constructed in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. Immense topographical changes will be necessary to accommodate this temple, which will be a mile square in dimension. The Bible presents an order of prophetic events that will climax with the building of this temple.
Price's mentor, and until recently the head of the Dallas Theological Seminary, is John Walvoord.
In Daniel 9, the prophet predicts the future of Israel, in particularly the last 7 years that lead up to the second coming of Christ. And in the covenant that is mentioned there, there is going to be a division of the 7 years into 2 halves, one of time of peace for 3.5 years, and then the time of the great tribulation. And in that, the Antichrist will take over the temple and take over and stop its sacrificial system, which had been begun by the Orthodox Jews, and will install the worship and service of himself.
Another of Walvoord's proteges, who is equally fanatical about the inevitability and desirability of sparking a fanatical religious war in the Middle East, is the famous televangelist Jerry Falwell.
There's general agreement among all the theologians today there will be a future temple in Jerusalem. We can only speculate this time how that might come to pass. The Muslims revere the Dome of the Rock as a holy shrine to commemorate the place where Muhammad supposedly ascended into heaven. There's no way they will ever willingly give up that place. And the only reasonable option would seem to be that it might be destroyed by warfare or terrorism or natural disaster like this earthquake. And only then could the Jews presume to rebuild the temple on that spot. Even that attempt would certainly be met with armed resistance throughout the Muslim world. The current interest in rebuilding the temple, the first of its kind in the last 1,400 years, is of significant merit. Something momentous is happening in the Middle East today that will soon affect the destiny of our entire planet.
Another of the fanatical Temple Mount advocates here in the United States is the best-selling author Tim LaHaye, who has produced a series of novels all effectively centered around the final days, the Battle of Armageddon, and the mythology of the Temple Mount.
The temple is a most significant institution designed by God as a symbol of his concern to bring man to himself. During the tribulation period, as we show in our fiction series, it is an expression of rebellion against God when Antichrist goes in and desecrates the temple and blasphemes in the name of God and actually sets his image up and demands that people worship him or Satan indwelling him. And it forces us to face the fact that in every generation, people have to make a choice. You have to make a choice. Are you going to surrender your will to God, or are you going to do your own thing? It's our prayer you surrender yourself to God.
Now, ask yourself, is Tim LaHaye's concept of God, of Christianity, of mission, your idea of God, Christianity, and mission, is the objective of Christianity to actually start a horrible, murderous religious war over the Temple Mount? I think not. I think a clear idea of the notion of religion that's conveyed by the LaHaye and by the Falwells and by the Walfords and by the Gershon Solomons is probably an image that was best captured as a form of extreme irrationalism in an old Hollywood movie, Elmer Gantry. And ask yourself if this kind of howling dog concept of man in the living image of God is your notion of religion.
Repent with Sister Falconer!
With the installation of Ariel Sharon as the Prime Minister of Israel, all of the major pieces have been put in place on the ground. As the EIR special report documents, this has been a systematic effort that's been underway since 1967. And in fact, at this point, the final training is underway for the temple priests who will be brought in to administer this final Temple Mount process after the enormous turmoil and real world genocide is conducted, if these people are allowed to get away with this. The Eteret Kohanim, which is a yeshiva adjacent to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, is training the priests, is practicing the ritualistic animal sacrifices, and is preparing for the day that they can move into the temple after the blowing up of the Islamic holy sites.
At Eteret Kohanim, students are studying to be Kohanim, the priest, and Leviim, the Levite. The 8-year program of this school includes courses in the rites and regulations of a priesthood, known as the order of the sacrifices of the temple, including those of the red heifer.
This insanity can and must be stopped. There's a tradition in Israel associated with the great German philosopher Moses Mendelssohn that was carried into the state of Israel through some of the ideas represented at his best moments by the former Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, an impulse towards economic development of the entire region, of the entire Middle East, the blossoming of a new oasis in which Jews and Arabs can successfully live side by side in sovereign nation states. But for that to happen, the first step must necessarily be for those people on the ground, in the region in particular, to wake up to the fact that they are pawns in an evil chess game that's being played from outside the region by those who would wish to see a clash of civilizations bring down all of humanity, destroy the nation-state system once and for all, and render what's left of the human race slaves to a London-centered oligarchy. Now, the purpose of the drafting and circulation of the EIR special report was to get the evidence out, the shocking evidence, to ensure that people do indeed wake up to what's going on before it's too late, before the Dome of the Rock, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, are blown up and the world is faced with World War III. On July 26th, an Israeli high court issued a ruling approving the laying of the cornerstone of the Third Temple of Jerusalem at the south gate of the Old City. And while the Temple Mount faithful's Gershom Solomon had originally requested permission to go up onto the Temple Mount itself and lay the stone at the site of the present Al-Aqsa Mosque, nevertheless, the fanatics hailed the court's decision as precedent-setting and are now preparing a major mobilization of forces and a rally for the laying of the stone. This incident may very well be the trigger for the unleashing of the guns of August. During his July 24th webcast, Lyndon LaRouche was asked about the prospects of this Middle East war danger and the Temple Mount threat. Let's listen to a brief segment from that webcast.
Okay, Lynn, the next question is from Jordan. It's a question that was submitted by Dr. Fahed Fenech. The question is, Mr. LaRouche, what do you think of the fact that Ariel Sharon has announced an assassination policy toward leading Palestinians? He's spoken publicly of a list of 46 names, and they are already being killed day by day. How is it possible that a democratic government can adopt a policy of executions beyond any judicial system, and the whole world sits and watches?
Well, on the question of Israel on this thing, I have the advantage of many years' experience with people in this area, negotiating, dealing with the issues in this area of the world. Now, to say that Israel is a democratic country is nonsense. It's not a democratic country. The people of Israel are an abused state. These people of Israel today are not the people who left Europe with Ben-Gurion, to join Ben-Gurion in the immediate post-war period. These are not the representatives of the Reformed Jew from Germany. These are not the legacy of the Yiddish Renaissance, of Poland, of Galicia, of Ukraine, Russia, and so forth. They're not. These are very poor people, very ignorant people, with no education. No education worth mentioning. These two, you know, when I grew up in the United States, Jews to me meant my friends from the Polish-Russian background, mostly Yiddish Renaissance, because that's the type, you know, they sort of, we sort of agree. Or German Jews, who were the Reformed Jews. We got along fine. We understood one another. The Jew from Germany, and also in Eastern Europe, represented, after the reforms of Moses Mendelssohn, represented the highest level of culture in the countries in which they lived. The contribution of German Jews to German culture from the time of Joseph II of Austria's giving political rights to the Jew was tremendous. Physicians, scientists, artists, so forth, beyond belief. A similar thing was done in Eastern Europe by the Yiddish Renaissance, which was a copy of this. These were the victims of Hitler. These are the ones who we have forgotten. We call them numbers. We don't call them people anymore. We don't remember their faces. We don't remember what they did. We don't remember what they were, what their contributions were. We now have a faceless mob of poor people, poor, ignorant, hysterical people with no education. They are a mob, a maddened, frightened mob who have this terrible legacy of what the Israelis call the Shoah. This terrible thing haunting them, sitting on top of them, destroying them. And they have terrible leaders. They have the majority of the Israeli leaders are nothing but gangsters. Oh, there are a few exceptions here and there. But essentially they think like gangsters. Sharon is essentially a gangster. He was a creature who was practically owned by the late Catherine Graham of the Washington Post, whose daughter managed him. He's not religious at all. He's just a gangster. His religion is gangsterism. You have others who have similar characteristics. They may talk one way at other times, but it's terrible. Yes, we have to think about the future. We have worked, and others have worked, to try to bring peace in the Middle East on the basis of an Israeli-Arab peace. We've tried, and we still try. We shall always try, as those who understand the lesson of the Treaty of Westphalia shall do. We must bring peace. We cannot have ethnic and religious warfare, which always leads to dark ages. There must be no religious warfare. We must end it any way possible. We must keep trying. But in the meantime, we don't have to sit back and put up with everything. The United States has the power and influence to influence the situation in the Middle East to stop this. I don't think the Israelis can stop themselves, by themselves. I don't think anybody in Western Europe, in the governments, has the guts to try by themselves. I think that only from the United States, a resolute leadership from the United States, which could secure European and other backing, could intervene effectively to persuade the government of Israel, we're not going to go with this. Now remember that the issue is this, the danger is this, and we have to look at statesmen. I mean, I know the passions of people involved in both sides of the shooting side of this event. People keep trying to think in terms of Israeli versus Arab or Israeli versus Palestinian. It's not so simple. This problem is a problem of manipulation, geopolitical manipulation by people who think like the RAND Corporation crowd. The RAND Corporation crowd is running the United States government right now, and not well at all. The systems analysis people. Their view has been, ever since that crazy geography teacher, Halton McKindler, back at the end of the last century, is that you have to use geography in a way to put people at each other's throats so nobody in continental Europe or continental Eurasia can get together to create an order of peace which could challenge the hegemony of the so-called maritime powers, which now includes nominally the United States as well as the United Kingdom and the British Commonwealth. That's the game. The game is not run from inside the Arab world. It's not run from inside Israel. The Israelis involved are nothing but puppets who are manipulated by psychological warfare specialists who know how to manipulate such merchandise. Their object in this is not to do something for Israel. They know, as I know, that if Israel takes the course it's now taking under Sharon and what might follow Sharon, Israel will cease to exist. It will be obliterated in the ashes of the conditions it creates. So those who are pushing Israel into this war are not pushing it for love or sympathy for Israel. They are using Israel as a puppet, as a gong, to destroy itself for the greater good of people behind people like Brzezinski. That's what they're doing. Where we have to put the pressure on. We have to put the pressure on this. And remember the operations of the following nature. RAND Corporation back in the 1960s and 1970s was running around with what they call a chicken game scenario, a nuclear chicken game scenario. The idea is that if you could get Israelis with nuclear weapons and some Arabs with some nuclear weapons or similar weapons, if they hated each other badly enough, you could get a war started that couldn't be stopped. And people were trying to say, how do you get this kind of war started that can't be stopped? You have to use fanatics. In past history, you've seen this in religious warfare. When Venice's power was threatened by the emergence of the nation state, Venice's response was to divide all Christianity into several parts, various kinds of Protestant, Catholic, and so forth, and to set them in war against each other. This became a period of religious warfare in Europe from 1511 until 1648, the Treaty of Westphalia. This is the way the game is being played, this kind of game. We in the United States, we know who these guys are, the game players. It's not the Arabs, it's not the Israelis, it's the game players who are playing one against the other. And we have the ability to stop them, and we should do it. I want your support to help.
Thank you, Len.
This has been a special edition of the LaRouche Connection, The Guns of August. My name is Jeff Steinberg.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements. Thank you.